Monster Man, Special Episode, Warforged. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon supporters, and in particular, the generosity of Patreon supporter Gerald, who has asked me to talk about The Warforged. If you'd like to be like Gerald and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, in which I take an in-depth look at the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition, and how to use it and to use religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. So, Gerald, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy this episode. Warforged are very interesting, not just as creatures, but also in terms of their publication history. I was thinking about this the other day. There are comparatively few creatures that have been added to the D&D canon subsequent to AD&D 1st edition. Most of what we think of as the characteristic beings of D&D, your mind flayers and your beholders, to say nothing of your orcs and your dragons and so forth, are products of the first Monster Manual. And then you get some later things. So the Myconids, for instance, are in Monster Manual 2. That's quite late. The Githyanki and Githzerai are in Fiendfolio. And second edition, I want to say, added Tieflings, who are sort of the big takeaway there. People do love Tieflings. And I feel like the Warforged are the equivalent for third edition. There's a thing from third edition that has gone on into later editions. There are probably some other ones as well, but that seems like the big one. I mean, I guess the Warforged are a specific case of Eberron going on into later editions, but like you will see games that are not set in Eberron that have Warforged characters. They really made a lasting impact on the overall D&D zeitgeist. Now, as I said, the Warforged were introduced in the Eberron setting, and I think that it's important to point out that one of the things about Eberron is that it is not a very medieval fantasy setting. It's a fantasy setting, but with more of an early modern feel to it, or even modern. This is a fantasy setting with things like total war, industrialization, newspapers, and so on. And as a result, it kind of addresses somewhat different themes than the more characteristically medieval D&D setting. And as I've said before, the medieval Dungeons & Dragons fantasy setting is not really all that medieval in many ways. But nonetheless, some of these themes would feel out of place there. So in the Eberron setting, Warforged are, they're not robots, they're not golems. They are artificial people. So they're synthetic people. They were created as soldiers during a vast conflict called the Last War. And when the war ended, by the peace treaty that ended it, they were granted the status of essentially sentient beings, right? So the society has, legally speaking, accepted Warforged as the equivalent of humans or other, you know, half-elves or what have you, right? So the equivalent of a sentient species capable of making their own decisions and not owned by anybody. However, because the Warforged were artificially created to be soldiers, many of them don't really have that much experience of civilian life. And in the Eberron setting, the Last War ended relatively recently. And so, for many Warforged, they are within the first experience of, you know, life outside the army. The Warforged quickly became kind of the standout popular thing from Eberron. I mean, not that people don't like Eberron, people certainly do, but the Warforged were really kind of the hit of Eberron. And I think this is for a couple of different reasons. And, I mean, first, I think obviously they appeal to the desire to play a robot. One of the things that I think you can really see developing as we go through the editions of Dungeons & Dragons is the shift away from a humanocentric game. You know, early editions of D&D are very much like you play a hero, you know, like Conan or Fafhrd or whoever, or at a push, Legolas or Gimli or Bilbo Baggins, and you explore a wild, strange environment full of deadly traps and monsters and treasures. But a bit like the experience of something like The Hobbit, you start out kind of like a regular person, right? Conan is extreme. both in his abilities and his beliefs, but he's not weird. He's unusual to the civilized people around him, but he is still a person, merely an exceptionally courageous, tough, and resourceful person. But as the game went on, I think many people began to be attracted by the appeal of playing a non-human character. And this, I think, goes hand in hand with the general shift, if we may, away from world-focused to character-focused play experience. As your character was no longer just the eyes through which you saw the world, playing things that were different from humanity came to be really important. And if you want to look at D&D streaming shows, for example, I think you'll see that very much. Right? Tieflings and Tabaxi and Warforged and Genasi and whatever, and that regular old humans are probably comparatively rare. And indeed, that human characters tend to exist in characters for whom their ordinary Joe status is important to who that character is. That's a side note. Anyway, people like playing different weird things. Among those different weird things is robots, and although the Warforged are not robots per se, they have many robot-like characteristics, and therefore they appeal to that group of fans. But I think they also show many of the other things that you want when you're creating a new race, race is the term that the game uses, but a new species, a new group, a new whatever, a new playable option in a fantasy setting. So let's take a look at what those ingredients are. First up, we have literary precedent. Literary precedent is very important historically for the inclusion of characters within Dungeons & Dragons. So obviously, the elf, dwarf, and halfling, which are added as playable options quite early on, are there because of The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Half-orcs less so. I don't think that specifically comes from a place, but obviously there are half-orcs in The Lord of the Rings. Many people are excited to play something because they are fans of that thing already. And also, when you encounter elves in a fantasy role-playing game, your sense of what elves are is already affected by having read books with elvish characters, or seen films, or played video games, or whatever, right? That you know that they will be aloof and distant and somewhat mysterious, but probably overall good. And we know that dwarves are gruff and sometimes short-tempered, and they hold grudges, and they don't have very good social graces, and they're tough, and so on and so on. So, same thing goes for robots. Whether it's the robot on Lost in Space, or whether it's Commander Data, whoever it is, there are enough robots in things, enough kind of android characters, indeed specifically often robot characters questioning their own humanity and their own purpose, which as we'll see is something that the Warforged are very into, that you will immediately have some understanding of what it means to interact with this character, even if, as I've said, Warforged aren't really robots per se. It doesn't matter. They have the literary associations of robots. Second, and I think that this is one of the most important factors and is often overlooked, the Warforged have a strong visual component. Third edition, when it came out, was frequently criticized for an art style that moved away from the traditional fantasy medievalist look of Dungeons & Dragons, but that did not quite adhere to any one look that was popular at the time. So 3rd edition definitely has a distinctive visual identity, but if you look at, say, 1st edition, 1st edition's depictions of characters that are obviously mainly based on medieval or classical archetypes looks quaint, but 3rd edition's looks dated. It looks like a game from around the year 2000, when we thought all that stuff was cool. And those art styles were not always successfully applied to the things that D&D had historically been about. In second, you could see that D&D had started to kind of like turn in on itself, but there were a lot of successes in visuals, and one of those examples was Dark Sun, where the setting's visual elements were focused around the work of a single artist, Gerard Brom. And by doing that, the setting was given a distinct visual identity. The same is very much true for Eberron. When I think of the artist that I associate with Eberron, it's Wayne Reynolds. And Reynolds' style is very, I don't quite know how to describe it. I guess chunky. It reminds me a little bit of some styles that were popular in comics in the late 90s and the mid 2000s. There's a lot of, exaggeration. Things are kind of oversized and not exactly cartoonish, but in particular, I think of, you know, like a lot of big blocky shapes. And that perfectly fits the design of the Warforged. Exaggeration, the lack of, you know, a necessary anatomy in artificial mechanical characters allowed that style to really express itself. And so the Warforged immediately had a distinctive visual identity that on the one hand communicated that they were robots, that they were artificial, but on the other hand, that they were fantastic. And I guess on the third hand, that they were, you know, humane and relatable. Very successful. I think the visual element should not be overlooked when thinking about how a player character option is taken up by the player base. That chunky, spiky, exaggerated look has stayed with the Warforged, even in portrayals of Warforged by other artists. One possible advantage that the Warforged have over other types of player character options is that they are created specifically for a game. They are not adapted from some other media. And what that means is that they can be created with an eye toward that character-focused style of play that had become so typical of role-playing games during the 1990s, and which is more than anything else exemplified by Vampire the Masquerade, the role-playing game of the 1990s, Vampire the Masquerade. For all its many flaws, had very effectively identified a way to simplify character creation in a way that was focused on the mood and the aesthetics and the conflicts of the character. So if you play a member of a particular vampire clan, then chances are that you want to either embrace or fight against the stereotype of your clan. So, you know, maybe you play a Brujah because you want to play a wild rebel who doesn't take anybody's crap and smacks all fuddy-duddies in the mouth. Or maybe you play a Brujah because you want to play a sensitive scholar who is frustrated that everybody assumes that all Brujah are wild rebels. But either way, that identity means something, and it means something even today. Those identities were simple and easy to express, and they were characterful. And while we may look at them as simplistic, they are a little bit like Stan Lee characterization. If you look at the characterization of the Fantastic Four in a Stan Lee Jack Kirby Fantastic Four issue from the 60s, it's going to seem simplistic until you compare it to the characterization in a Batman comic from the 1950s. Introducing those simple, relatable elements of personality as an aspect of character creation made the Warforged feel modern. In a way that, you know, humans and half-elves and so forth had to evolve into being. And maybe the humans never did, which may explain their modern unpopularity. The Warforged have these conflicts built in. First, they have an internal conflict. The Warforged have been created for war, and although they're intelligent and although they're self-aware, they're not just weapons. They typically have very little experience of peacetime or of non-military society. They were created for violence and conflict. They're used to serving, and there are those who believe that that is their purpose. But for many Warforged, the end of the war means that they don't really know what their purpose is. They have to find it for themselves. They were made for one thing, and that thing is done. So, where do they start? Obviously, some of them, drawing on their experience of the military or whatever, they pick up a sword, they pack their meager belongings into a bindle, and they set out into the world to seek fame and fortune as an adventurer, right? But there's always this element of internal conflict. Warforged have a question, not an answer, at the heart of who they are. And that's a very important thing when you're creating a player character option. Character generation choices ask questions. Players answer them. Secondly, the Warforged also have an external conflict, because not everybody is wild about them. And this conflict works as well as it does, which I think is not necessarily very well, but it works as well as it does because of the more modern industrialized nature of the Eberron fantasy setting. Warforged are robots, so what are our anxieties? I mean, they're not robots, but that clearly everything about them is meant to make you think robots. So what are our anxieties about robots? Well, the first is, what does it mean to be human? Are these things human? Are they sentient? Are they self-aware? Are they, in a word, people? And the second is our anxiety about industrialization. You know, a lot of the living people who object to Warforged object on the grounds that they took their jobs. You know, the Warforged came out of the army, they don't eat, they don't sleep, they don't breathe, they work cheap. And just like in, I don't know, Napoleonic England, peacetime brings demobilized soldiers home into an economy where unemployment is high. So urban unrest can sometimes be focused toward this unpopular minority during a time of high unemployment. Now, this doesn't work as well, because ultimately the Warforged are not a product of industrialization. One of the rules of the peace treaty, the end of the last war, is that no more Warforged may be produced. And of course, producing them is the MacGuffin of different plots and whatever, but that's not important here. The point is that, unlike industrialization, the Warforged don't represent some kind of unstoppable, or at least unstopped, wave of societal change. They're just effectively a new immigrant group in the big cities of Eberron. And, you know, similarly, the fact that we know the Warforged are thinking, feeling beings does kind of weaken the is it a human thing. It turns it less into a question and more into Warforged face unjustifiable persecution from bigots. Nonetheless, these things fit reasonably well with Eberron, and they help reinforce the tonal elements of the setting itself. So you kind of know what sort of society you're dealing with in Eberron because there are these issues of things that are less common in the pseudo-medieval fantasy settings of D&D, although they do come up. But, you know, issues like industrialization, the fate of the urban working class, you know, the relationship of technology to society, all these sorts of things, right? What if drones had feelings? One of the things that's hastened the spread of the Warforged outside the Eberron setting is that in many ways, the modernizing assumptions of Eberron have, I don't want to say that they've bled into other fantasy settings, more that they represent a similar trend to one that's been going on in fantasy settings. I don't know that I can put numbers on this. This is merely my subjective impression. But from what I see people posting about on social media and things like that, it seems like a lot of players, particularly a lot of players who are primarily rooted in 5th edition, have tended to move away from the idea of medievalism as something that is inherent to Dungeons & Dragons. Early editions of the game were very obviously focused on antecedents from medieval and classical history, and that made sense because the people who created that game, and by extension it was assumed the people who played it, were history buffs. And I think that there has become, thanks to the proliferation of fantasy media and fantasy literature and so forth, I think the link between fantasy and romanticism is kind of gone, or at least is no longer what it once was. So I think it is no longer the case that we can assume that if you like fantasy fiction, you almost certainly also like medieval history. Although obviously many people who read fantasy fiction also read historical fiction, and I think we see that reflected in the more eclectically anachronistic nature of D&D games these days. And of course that medievalism was always kind of porous, right? There are always going to be kind of 17th, 18th century pirates in this allegedly medieval D&D setting. They're always going to kind of be pseudo-Romans and what have you, but I do feel like modernish elements in fantasy settings are more common than they were when 2nd edition AD&D made the transition to 3rd. So those are the things that I think have made the Warforged such a successful player character option in Dungeons & Dragons, right? One of only a handful of new ones that have been introduced since 1st edition. Now, when I say successful, I'm not trying to judge things that have not quite, like, captured the public imagination. But I do feel that, like, Warforged have become more commonplace in the kind of D&D imagination, not than, say, tieflings. I think tieflings are now understood as core to the game in a way that, like, Genasi or Arakokra are not. Tabaxi, Warforged may be kind of on a par with Tabaxi. A lot of people seem to like to play Tabaxi because a lot of people like kitty cats and a lot of people like robots. They're both cool. Everybody likes those things. One detail that I really liked that I couldn't find a way to work into this list anywhere is the idea that Warforged have exactly the same level of completely rich internal emotional life that any other thinking being has. So just like an elf or a human or a halfling, Warforged have, you know, they're not unemotional. They absolutely have the same feelings as anybody else. What they don't have are facial expressions. They tend to be built with kind of blank, emotionless faces because the people who created them didn't care what they felt. They just cared that they didn't get smashed in the mug. And I feel like the featureless Warforged face owes a certain amount to Optimus Prime, but I don't know that I have a a source for that, but the kind of emotionless mask of a warforged body tends to make people who are not warforged think that warforged are unemotional. It's not that they don't have emotions, it's that they lack the tools that humans use or that other emotional beings use to express those emotions. And that, I think, is a really interesting point and a really interesting role-playing note, that they have these emotions and they were not given the tools to express them. And I think that that might be something that a lot of people feel like they can relate to. You know, I have feelings and somehow I'm unable to make you, the people that I care about, understand what those feelings are. I think that that's quite a common human experience. It neatly subverts the kind of Commander Data thing, or even the Mr. Spock thing, where the more you shine a light on the character's supposedly unemotional nature, the more it becomes clear to us that we don't have a good way of conceptualizing what a character who didn't have emotions would be like. So yeah, that's why I think the Warforged are successful. That's why I think they're one of the things from that era of D&D that has survived into the modern game. Even though they're not in the 5th edition core rulebook, they certainly have made their reappearance now that there's Eberron stuff back out. And even in games that are not set in Eberron, if you look at popular D&D streaming shows or things like that, you will see Warforged characters in them, even though those games aren't set in Eberron. And I think that analyzing the success of the Warforged is an interesting way to think about how we create other player character options. I was racking my brains trying to think what the 4th edition one was, and it's the Dragonborn, of course. It's the lizard guys. I know he's a controversial figure, and I know that a lot of people object to the essay, Fantasy Heartbreakers, but in the Fantasy Heartbreakers essay, Ron Edwards suggests that by looking at the ways in which people sought to improve on AD&D, you can see, you know, what they thought was missing, and that one of the things that they thought was missing was either cat people or dragon people. People want to play kitty cats, they want to play dragons, they want to play robots, hot devils, and those all seem like things people obviously like and things people would obviously like to play. And I guess this is a look at how those things that people want to play are translated into the game as it is played. All right, that's about all the time that we have for this episode. Gerald, I hope you enjoyed this dive into the Warforged. It's not very Eberron lore-y, it's more kind of design thoughtsy, but I thought that that was really the interesting thing that emerged as I started to kind of dig into these good robots. If you'd like to be like Gerald and get your own special episode, remember that all you've got to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level, or if you would prefer, you can pledge at another level. There's 3 to choose from. In our next episode, we're going to be returning to the Creature Catalog, the 1986 supplement for Basic Dungeons & Dragons, and we're going to be looking at the Kna, a mercantile fishman, and the Lupin, a dog-like or wolf-like creature that is not a werewolf, all right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.